every legislator has been briefed, to best of my knowledge, on the issues, so maybe we can move along. I'd like to, if possible, be out of here by 10:30. So with that, we could – Senator Scheid moves the
– Yes. March to approve the minutes.
Approve the March 27th minutes. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. The next issue is review, approve collective bargaining agreement with the Minnesota State University Administrative and Service Facility. Good morning and welcome. And always, anybody that testifies, always state your name and who you're with. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Mary Leary, the Associate Vice Chancellor for Labor Relations, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and with me is Chris Dale.
I'm the System Director for Labor Relations, and I report to Mary Leary.
Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. We have before you this morning the contract with the Minnesota State University Administrative and Service Faculty. The you have been provided a summary. I'll go through the highlights of it. If you have additional questions, I will answer those. The adjustments include 1.5% increase in salary at the beginning of fiscal years 08 and 09. Each eligible faculty member will also receive a step increase effective July 1st, 07 and July 1st, 08. Step increases are approximately 3%. In the first year, employees at the top of their salary ranges receive a lump sum of $2,200. And a step is added to the grid the second year. Medical doctors covered by this contract receive a 4.5% increase July 1st of 07 and July 1st of 08. Then there's a continuation of benefits that have been prior year's contracts, including the requirement that each faculty member with 5 years service contribute 5%. Of the first $6,000 to the health care savings plan, the employer contributes $300 each year. Continue to match an employee's contribution to a supplemental retirement account to the maximum of $2,200. Continue the exceptional achievement programs with rewards up to 10% for employees with lump sum payments up to 5% of the employee's salary. The contract requires extensive evidence of performance and meeting numerous criteria. Continue the special initiative award in which faculty individually or as a group propose and implement projects that are a benefit to the university, its mission, or the Minsky system. As determined by the president, the maximum award is $5,000, which is provided as a lump upon completion of the projects. Other provisions that are in the contract include the implementation of the state's employee group insurance program as provided in other contracts. Increase the funding for professional development funds for employees for workshop conferences and courses from $300,000 to $315,000 per year. Also increase the professional improvement funds from $70,000 to $100,000 per year for grants to employees for staff training and development. Modify the sick leave provisions to permit fathers to use up to 5 days of sick leave at the birth of a child. Continue the tuition waiver up to 27 credits. Continue sabbaticals for employees with at least 6 years of service. Continue the separation incentive and the early retirement notice. The settlement cost sheet is attached. And the total cost of these increases is approximately $4,763,000 in FY08 to 09.
Okay. And
do you have any questions?
Sir, did you wish to comment, or is that okay? Any questions of on this? Is this the last one of the?
This is the last of the Minsky contracts.
Okay, that's what I thought, yeah. Okay, any, do we need a some kind of a motion then to, is that in the blue?
That's correct.
Okay, there's an appropriate, is that the number one,
yes.
This thing here? Just the first one?
So moved,
this,
Mr.
This
Chair.
Resolution approves that contract.
Okay, the SER1 blue motion approves what we're talking about. So
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, on that motion by Representative Hilstrom. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got review, approve amendments to the commissioner's plan and the managerial plans. Mr. Larson, welcome. How are you today?
Good morning, Mr. Morning. Chairman. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the state labor negotiator and also the assistant commissioner for the newly reorganized Department of Finance and Employee Relations. To my left, I have Mr. Mike Tessner, who is the chief executive officer for the Department of Human Services state-operated services. I thought it would be helpful to bring Mr. Tessner along in case there are any questions with one of the amendments that I have before you today. I have three amendments to the commissioner's plan and to the manager's plan. Actually, one amendment to the manager's plan and to the commissioner's plan, and I think it would be helpful if I give you a little background on this, and that is that
Larson, these can be found on the what we have up here at the SER 2. These are the amendments we're talking about, just so all the members.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Everybody knows it.
I'll look. I want to make
Mr.
sure.
Mr. Chair, the discussion is on page 3 of his memo.
Okay.
Mr. Huber, here's your memo, too.
Yeah. That's correct.
All right.
And maybe what I'll do is I'll take them in that order, then I think that would be helpful. But just for background is that any changes that occur in the commissioner's plan or manager plan require subcommittee approval.
Yeah.
And so having said that, what we have here is a proposal for the job classification medical specialist 1, 2, 3, and 4 in our commissioner's plan. The medical specialists for the executive branch are, in layman's terms, are actual medical doctors. And our doctors are employed at the Department of Human Services, the Veterans Homes, and the Department of Corrections. Having said that, the medical specialists we've experienced recruiting and retention issues in the area of psychiatry in the Department of Human Services, particularly in the state-operated services. And we, when we met with the group, Mr. Tessner and the other representatives of the Department of Human Services, we were discussing creating a new job classification that would be unique to the area of specialty services in psychiatry. Unfortunately, they've informed us that they cannot wait. We do have vacant positions out there. And so as a result of that, we have agreed to temporarily fix this by adding a 10% differential for our medical specialists while they are performing this unique psychiatric services. And we're looking in particularly the area of forensic psychiatry, child psychology, and addiction psychiatry. Okay. This would currently, I've asked for an analysis of this. It would impact about 8 of the medical specialists that we have. We are also creating a 20% differential for the medical systems director in the area of psychiatry for the Department of Human Services. What we're also doing is that we're trying to be creative in the area of how we were going to cost and how we were going to fund this proposal. Currently, we've been in discussions with the Department of Human Services in the area of on-call pay. And one of the areas that we've been in discussions had to do with a feature in the medical specialist's plan where they receive 4 hours of straight time pay on weekends and holidays. Currently, on-call pay typically is 15 minutes for every hour that you're on call. We've worked this out with the Department of Human Services that they will no longer pay the 4 hours of straight time pay at the rate for those 4 hours, but rather the 15 minutes on call, which will free up a substantial amount of money. And so what we're looking at, the differentials in total that I'm sharing with you today will, for this biennium, cost about $338,000, and our goal would be to try to offset this by the changes that we're making in the on-call. Our amendment has a date specific on when this differential will end. And so our goal is that by the next time that we're before you with the next round of agreements and plans, that we will have a new job classification, and we hope that that will ameliorate and help us. But we need this temporary fix. And so I have that. And then the other thing that I have is that the commissioner's plan this round had a 1% health care savings account created for the employees in the commissioner's plan. And as you know, the health care savings account, in order for that to exist and be tax sheltered, it has to be mandatory, and no one has the choice of either opting in or opting out. And the medical specialists are a subset of the commissioner's plan, and we did not put those people in that 1%. It turns out that after discussions, Mr. Tessner met with the representatives of the medical specialists. They do want to be in that 1% deduction, consistent with the other medical special, commissioner plan employees. And so we have also brought that amendment to you as well. So what we really have is we've got the medical specialists, we have the creation of the differentials that has date specifics, when it's going to end. We do have an explanation of where the cost was and what it's going to, how we're going to fund it. We also have a change in the on-call pay instead of the 4 hours of straight time pay. And then we are also including them in the 1% that is the employee contribution. It's not an employer contribution into that health care savings account. And so I hopefully have been able to explain what the amendment is, that what we need, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
How long does a temporary date go to?
July of 2010. July of 2009. Mr. Chair, yes.
But we're going to have to, at that time, fix it up permanently, I would guess.
Mr. Chair, my goal is that we will have the new job classes created by then.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, in describing the amendments, our memo refers to one that actually takes some employees out of the 1% deduct for health care savings. I don't recall hearing you just explain that. And I don't see it on the blue line. Maybe that's A.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, there were three amendments, and I guess I just want to make sure here that if you have no questions of Mr. Tessner, I can proceed because that is another that I can move to.
Mr. Chair, our blue thing refers to four amendments, not three, but you're referring to three. The three that you've described, and then this is another addition. Okay, I'll withdraw it until you have questions answered.
Okay, Senator Betzel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I did have a little bit more information, and I guess Mr. Tessner would be able to discuss that. Apparently, there's been quite a bit of turnover with the psychiatrists, and that's what this one amendment does. Could you give us a little bit more information about that,
Mr. Chair? Senator Betzel. Actually, the turnover has been relatively consistent, but as Senator, as you're aware, there's been a substantial increase in compensation for psychiatrists in particular, as health plans have put more money into the mental health system. We have to compete in hiring and retaining from Regents Hospital, Hennepin County Medical Center, and other hospitals recruiting psychiatrists. So the pressure on psychiatry vacancies and filling them is about the same. The compensation has gone up, and what this is trying to do is to get us in the field so that we can recruit and retain based upon compensation.
Thank you,
Senator Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson, or Mr. Tessner. It wasn't too many years ago that the private sector was also having a great deal of difficulty with child psychiatrists in particular. Is there still a general overall shortage that we're fighting, or is it the competition between the private and the public sector at this point?
I can answer.
That, Mr. Tessner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, there is consistently a shortage of child analysis and psychiatry. So once again, we need to get our compensation so we're competitive when we're out recruiting these folks.
Mr. Chair, do you know in particular there are not that many child psychiatry spots even in the state as a whole? Do you know how many are vacant or what percentage in the state or the nation are unfilled at this point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, I can just speak to state operated services at this point. We can get you the information on the shortage throughout the state and nationally.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, if I can answer that from the Department of Finance and Employee Relations perspective, one of the challenges that we seem to be facing more and more and more in the area of the medical services, and particularly the specialized services like psychiatrists, is Greater Minnesota. No matter what we do from the pay point of view in Greater Minnesota, it poses a huge challenge for us. And I certainly support the idea that we bring our services to our constituents throughout the entire state, but it does pose a very unique and challenging event for us to have to deal with psychiatrists that are willing to serve and live and provide those services in Greater Minnesota. We frequently enter up into professional contracts because of that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Larson.
It's got to be tough out there recruiting, I would think, in Greater Minnesota.
Okay.
Yes, you may.
Continuing on, actually, Senator Olson, this would then be in your sub SER 2, sub A. This has to do with a minor change in the commissioner's plan with respect to the health care savings account, and that has to do with, and I think that just to kind of transition this in, is whenever we create something as what I would consider as global as this health care savings account, we're going to have some discoveries after the event. And what we found out in that is that we have a group of employees that we call insufficient work time employees. And the insufficient work time employee is an employee who does not meet bargaining unit eligibility. So the question I'm assuming is, what does that mean? And that is that in order to be placed into a labor agreement under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, an employee has to be scheduled to work and work 67 days in a calendar year or for a minimum of 14 hours in a work week. And those are the two tests that are applied for the public sector jurisdictions under PELRA. So if you hire an employee that's going to work less than those criteria, where do they belong? Where do we put them? And so the provision in 43A says if you're not represented by a bargaining agreement, this is where you go. So the insufficient work time employees are placed in the commissioner's plan. And that can be what we call an intermittent employee, that they work maybe a month or two. It could be a part-time employee that's scheduled for less than those hours. So it's not a predictable schedule. It's not of any length and duration. And what we felt, and some of the agencies contacted us as we were transitioning into this 1% healthcare savings account, that their checks aren't significant enough in the first place. They're not predictable in the sense of income, and for us to decide that we're going to continue to take that 1% out for that group, it would just be unwise to do so. This was a request that came in from the agencies that do use the insufficient work time employees. And so what we're doing here is we are excluding insufficient work time employees from that 1% health care account. So that's what that amendment is.
Okay. Any further questions on any of the amendments here?
The other in the final amendment that I have has to do with a provision in the commissioner's plan and manager plan for employer-paid retiree insurance for our correctional plan employees and our law enforcement employees. This is a bit of a cleanup proposal, and what we have here is that for employees that are in the correctional plan and the state patrol retirement plan, we pay for their insurance when they retire at age 55. We pay that until age 65, plus we also pay for the increases. And the language in our labor agreements and pay plans require that we also pay for any increases that occur during that period of time. Basically, what we do is we treat them as if they were active employees. And we also have a provision in there that if you retire with single coverage and subsequently pick up a dependent, in other words, if you marry or possibly if you adopt a legal dependent or whatever, you can add that person to your pool, or they can be part of our CGIP population, but you have to pay for it. And that's been a feature in our pay plan and labor agreement for many years, since about 1985. But there's one exception to that, and that is that if you are married to a state employee, if you are married to a state employee and you retire at age 55 and your state employee is still working and is still part of our CGIP population, and then they subsequently retire, we will allow that, in most that circumstance, that we will pick up the spouse of the state employee and we will pay the cost for that. And it's something that we have done for several years, and the language in the pay plan does not reflect that. And this is part of my legacy of trying to clean this up, and this is something that we want to get in there because it does pose a question. And so we have discussed this at the bargaining table with other unions, and we're cleaning it up in that as well.
This legacy, will this go on your tombstone?
Mr. Chair, I have a lot of experience with that retirement plan.
All right, any does that do
that's it.
Explain all the amendments?
I believe it does.
Any questions of the members? Senator Betzel?
Just a clarification. you say you have the exception, of course, if one state employee is married to another state employee. What happens if they divorce? Does that affect anything? Does it change it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, I'll do the best to answer that question, and then Mr. Nathan Morocco could possibly help me with that, and I know he's scheduled it. But typically, if you are divorced, you lose that dependent status unless the court orders it. No, that's my answer.
Okay. Any...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just thinking, how often can this happen? And we're the state's paying then the insurance for the spouse of the correctional. I mean, it is the law enforcement people or the correctional people or the patrol people, and it's their spouse that's having their coverage paid for, right? And they don't have to be in the same and probably aren't in the same work group. They're maybe working in an office or whatever. So, but the state's paying their health care.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, that is correct. So, in other words, if you're a correctional plan employee and you retire at age 55, and if your spouse is working in an agency that's not, let's say they're working at Commerce, for example, I'll just use that as an example in an analyst job class. And then they retire, and you say that the correctional plan employee is 58 years old, we will then allow them to pick up the family coverage for that. We will allow that. In anticipation of your question, I just went through our system right now, and in instances where we had people that had single coverage when they retired and were married to a state employee and subsequently picked up the state employee, we have 22 people. That's
okay.
Currently, we have a total of 836 people that we are paying retiree insurance in those two plans.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions of members? take a moment, Senator Lilly, or Representative Lilly, did you? Senator, or Representative?
You want me to move, Mr. Chair, SCR 2?
Okay, we have a motion to approve the SCR 2. Further discussion? All those in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. The next item on our agenda is review approved proposed salary increases. There's three categories here. Which is a Retirement Association, Public Employee Retiree Association, Minnesota State Retirement Association. Welcome to the LCC Commission. And did you put enough quarters in the machine out there this morning? Huh? You dropped one on the ground, though, too. Did you get that?
Oh, I did.
I picked it up, though.
Bankers pay attention to that stuff.
I saw that distinguished-looking man putting the... Okay.
Good morning, Senator Betson and committee members. I'm Curtis Hutchins, president of the Teachers Retirement Association. And on my left is Dennis Hegberg. He's the president of his group, the Public Employees Retirement Association. And on my right, I have Mary Benner. She's the chair of the Minnesota State Retirement Association system.
Okay, Marty.
We're here to request approval by this committee for a salary increase of our executive directors of the they happen to be the executive directors of the retirement systems of Minnesota, the three largest ones. Currently, they are capped at a salary of 85% of the governor's salary, and we are requesting a salary increase to the 95% level of the governor's salary. This was, if you recall, this past legislative session, this was approved and enacted into law in the past legislative session under Chapter 363. It was originally contained in a separate independent bill that was what you would call a standalone bill, Senate File 2120 and House File 2424, which was introduced in early 2007. That bill was authored by several members of the Legislative Pension Commission as well as members of this committee. And then later on, the director's salaries were included in a more comprehensive bill, Senate File 2736 and House File 3095. And that affected all the agency heads that were considered this year. The three of us really are, I don't know how you could say it, I don't know if there are enough adjectives, but we are very pleased with the work of our executive directors, and that's on behalf of our boards too. And I'm going to go through some of the things I think you have in your own packets. I also have copies of a McLaughlin study that I believe you have in your packet, and we also have the vice president of that group, Chris Murphy, with us. If you have questions about the study, he's in the audience as a resource. And they are compensation specialists. Looking at salary increases for these three individuals, we feel it is very warranted when you think about what's happening within the state. Recently, the Legislative Coordinating Commission approved the executive director position for the legislative executive director of the Commission on Pensions and Retirement with a ceiling of $131,263. That's $17,000 higher than what we are asking for our current request for our executive directors. And if you keep in mind the longevity of our three executive directors, all three of them have more than 20 years of legislative pension experience, and they have considerable administrative responsibilities. They each manage staffs of over 100 people, and they also have significant financial responsibilities, overseeing benefit increases of over $2.5 billion annually, and the collection of contributions of over $1.5 billion annually. And if you combine the three together, they service over 500,000 people, and that's like one in every 10 Minnesotans. Nationally, when you look at a comparison, and I believe you have the McLaughlin study in your packet, you will see that the salary increases that we are asking for are very reasonable when you compare to other states. We are actually conservative when you even look at the low quartile in your packet of the largest public pension funds nationwide. Even at the lowest quartile, the range is $141,000. If you look at the median of those funds, it's $175,000. We're basically asking for $114,288, so we feel that's very warranted. You look at some of the other Minnesota pension funds, which are much smaller, service a much smaller clientele, such as Murph or St. Paul or Duluth. They even make salaries that are above what our executive directors make. So as I said before, our boards including ourselves, are very pleased with the performance of our executive directors. They are evaluated every year, and each of them has, like I said, over 20 years of pension experience in the field. And if you look at each one of them, the MSRS director has 16 years as the director. The PERA director has 12 years of leadership, and the TRA director has 8 years in Minnesota and 7 years in Ohio. So I could go on and on and tell you about our executive directors, but I think if you look at your packet, if you look at what I've just told you.
I think you've made a pretty good case there, Mr. Hutchins, and I think all the members have looked at this
McLagan.
Report.
Questions?
And I'm a believer that you do have to pay people, good people, to hang around. So, Senator Shide, did you have a...
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. Okay. I don't know if it's for Mr. Hubinger or Mr. Hutchins. Concerning this, we apparently took the 85% of the governor's salary level up to 95% this legislative session.
Correct.
And that was a good thing. But are you then... So I'm guessing the 102 was at the 85%, and
it was the top of level two. Yes.
So are we going above the? I mean, this doesn't go above the 95%. So I'm not understanding. If we did that, why do we have to do this?
We did it legislatively. Is that correct?
Yes.
Chapter 363. It's already done. Yeah,
and Mr. Chairman, I don't oppose doing it. I want to do it.
That's a good point. If we did it by law, I guess I might.
You did it by law allowing it.
Oh, allowing. So we have to ratify, or we have to. Okay.
Thank you.
Because I do remember that discussion.
A light bulb just went off. Thank you.
Good that you have a light bulb. Representative Bigham.
That was similarly my question, but kind of the next step was when's the last time? It's in our memo here, but when is the last time any of the directors have received a raise?
An increase?
Yes.
They received, Representative Bigham, increase last year. I was in front of this group last year. They received an increase last year up to the $102,000 level. It was a 2.3% increase at the time.
Okay. This is 2000.
Representative Forrest.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Morning. Good to see you, my friend.
Yep. Thank you. This is the first time I've been on a bed before 9 a.m. in about
eight weeks. Or me? You.
Oh, yeah.
I think both.
Goofing off, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't quarrel with the authorizing document. I'll certainly vote for it. But I did have a couple of questions, if you'd indulge it, three questions about the study. If as Mr. Murphy perhaps could have just maybe two or three questions.
Well, I think that fits in now. That's good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Murphy, in looking at the study, I had a question that stems from comparable groups, peer groups, which, of course, is extremely important when trying to define how people should be paid. And and if you look at page four, well, I've got a memo on page four here that says, the survey did not appear to compare other demographic data such as operating budgets or number of employees. And I'm curious with respect to the studies that you did, are you given criteria by the person for whom you work regarding what the peer group should be, or do you have a defined a set of criteria you use to define a peer group when you do a study for somebody? In other words, simply put, how do you determine what the peer group is going to be?
Typically, we...
Give you a state your name and for the record.
Sure. Oh, my name is Chris Murphy. I'm a senior consultant at McLagan. We did the... we provided the data... for executive director salary information for this analysis. Typically what we do is we recommend a peer group based on various criteria. What we do as a company is we on an annual basis we collect salary and bonus information from public pension funds. So there's about 65 funds that participate in our annual survey. And as part of that survey, we collect information such as membership, beneficiaries, things like that. We collect information. I believe we have some information on employees, but I'd have to number of employees in the systems, but I'd have to go back and check that. We don't collect information about operating budgets, but typically what we'll do is recommend a comparator group to use as a guideline. So in this case, we felt since the ultimate since ultimately the directors are responsible for serving beneficiaries and membership, okay, and overseeing the operation of the fund to ensure that they're given the highest level of service, we felt that membership was an appropriate approach. So in order to get a gauge on what the market pays, we chose a range of about $50,000 to $200,000, recognizing that the three systems have a different size in terms of people that they're serving, but we felt that that was a good gauge.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Murphy, was that a sole criterion then?
That we use that as a sole criteria.
Okay.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the next question I would have is, it appears when we look at a lot of these documents, we tend to be focused on salary, which is obviously important. Do you take into account total compensation? Do you look at retirement benefits, for example, and attempt to monetize that and add that in, or do you strictly look at salary when you collect data from a peer group?
When we collect data from a peer group, we strictly look at salary and then any cash bonuses that are paid.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, if I could then, could I ask Mr. Larson then just a question or two?
Mr. Larson, you're a witness.
That's right. Put that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Larson, the question I had is at least I'm not sure we're comparing apples to apples. And I said my point here isn't to suggest that the salary range that is offered is out of line or isn't correct. But I'm concerned that perhaps we're not using best practices, at least in my experience with human resources and the like. I don't know if strictly collecting salary data as well as excluding or not even looking at the geography of certain jurisdictions. For example, you may have something included in there from Southern California or maybe the New York City area where the cost of living is higher. I just don't know. But my question to you, not regarding that practice, but does the state of Minnesota have any guidelines? It seems to me I'm getting the impression that these compensation surveys and the like are done helter-skelter with utterly no regard for perhaps the public policy we're trying to implement here in with respect to our compensation system and the like. It seems folks are sort of going out on their own and getting compensation surveys done with their own criteria, which seems to maybe even change within a state agency from year to year or from survey to survey. They may look at different peer groups. And my question, simply put, is are there any guidelines with respect to these surveys that are done by the various agencies?
Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Forest, in a sense of are there any guidelines, there is a provision in 43A that talks about total compensation, but I would say that from a market point of view, we probably don't look at those. We usually look at total compensation in 43A in determining the salary maxes for agency heads. But just anecdotally speaking to you in my professional capacity, we often have to deal with this in labor negotiations with our organized units on negotiating our labor agreements. And typically what we try to do is we look at the internal equity first. Any large employer looks at internal equity first, and then we also then look at the external market. And I do agree with you, what we do look at, for example, our state employee insurance program, for example, not too many employers out there that family coverage is at the rate that employees have to contribute there. And so in our negotiations with our other unions, we quickly remind them that it's not uncommon that in the other public sector jurisdictions, employees are paying anywhere from $300 to $600 a month for family coverage, which we're not even close to that. And then as far as our plan design and so on, pension, we have a defined benefit pension program as opposed to a defined contribution. So what we typically do is add all that stuff back in. And that's where the give and take and the bargaining process ends. And quite frankly,
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Forest, we've been very successful in arbitration when we lay all of the compensation on the table. So we no. The blunt answer is no. We do not use strictly salary.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, thanks. Thank you. And Mr. Larson, I would agree. I don't know if I was representing a union or management if I would accept a salary survey that gave no regard to geography and only collected salaries. I just don't. It's not broad enough. I don't put a lot of weight into it. Although I have done enough research and been around here long enough to know that I think that some of our folks here, SBI and the like, certainly a salary increase, there is merit to it. As I said, my point here isn't to dispute this document. I'll be voting for it. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence. I'll just wrap up. You know, I'm on my way out of here, so I'm trying to do what I can before I get out of here to put something put on my tombstone, maybe. I don't know. But it seems...
I hope that tombstone message isn't too soon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope not. My doctor gave me a clean bill of health last week, so I think I'm okay.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, to make a serious point here, I have had just an overall concern as a member of this subcommittee that increasingly our compensation system is making less and less sense. We're paying people similarly situated increasingly different amounts of money. And, you know, you can argue which way is it too high or too low on either end, but that's not my point. My point is I think simply our job is to lend coherency to the state's compensation system, a rational system that pays similarly situated people sort of the same amount of money. And I think this is one of the contributing problems when we sort of go out and do salary surveys without any kind of public policy or guidance offered by the state as to how it should be done. And that's just my only point, is I feel this is sort of coming apart at the seams, and we're getting increasing disparity between people who are rightly saying, I do a similar job to Lanning. Why is he making $40,000 more than I am? And I think what it is doing is it's breeding a certain amount of resentment amongst some classes of our state employees if you talk to them. And we've got to work really hard to have a good, rational compensation system because, you know, those recruiting challenges are hard. We hear that all the time here. So, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence again. It's a deep concern of mine that we have a good compensation system that makes people, good, talented people, want to work for the state. Thanks.
Any further questions? I think you've got the order, so you maybe...
Senator, may I respond to his comments?
Shortly.
Representative De La Forest, your questions are very insightful. I've been on the TRA, Teachers Retirement Association Board, for 20 years. I constantly do research. Normally when I come in front of this board, we use different research. Like last year when I was here, we used the Missouri study, which used... basically the same criteria that was passed on to the McLaughlin group. And if you look at the second page, you'll notice the select public funds that are very comparable. That it is a cross-section of the U.S., as you were talking about. But they also look at, which wasn't mentioned by the vice president here of the group, but they also look at who has investment authority and who does not. So it's a little bit more than just looking at salaries. A lot of them, they try and look at size. They look at comparable roles that those executive directors have. And I have to be honest with you, in almost the whole 20 years that I've been doing research on these kinds of topics, we have been in that bottom quartile for our executive directors, not just the current ones, but the previous ones also, if that helps you. But thank you for your insightful questions.
Okay. Any further discussion? We're ready to Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
Of Mr. Murphy. Is it appropriate now or regarding
think so.
The study?
I think so. Good. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Murphy, a couple of questions. You mentioned that you don't collect operational information, operational cost information. Is that correct? Did I hear you correct?
Correct. Operating budget information and things like related to that, we do not collect that.
So in comparing our situation with those in the peer groups that you've looked at here, you're then not in a position to compare our overhead costs, operational costs of our programs to those same peer groups. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Can you offer any... observation from what you have learned, or is that something you're not able to do?
No, it's we were asked to provide data, and we did not do an analysis specific to whether pay for the executive directors here was at the right level or not, because from what we understood, there was this 85% of governor's salary. So we weren't asked to do any of that. We strictly were providing data, but what we were trying to do was just in terms of looking at size, in terms of membership or the beneficiaries, we felt it was probably appropriate in that the elements of administering a plan are probably the same across the board. So while budgets might be different, the same elements and complexities and other types of things that are important to a successful administration are probably all embedded, you know, within what the person's role is. What the guidance or the direct what our goal was directionally to provide information based on size and who you're ultimately serving in order to be effective in the job. Does that help or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, one more question, if I might, Mr. Murphy. With respect to the State Board of Investment part of your study here, what about comparisons with the peer group in terms of to what extent the funds farm out their investment to outside firms? What can you say about where Minnesota ranks there, how Minnesota compares with the different peer groups with respect to the extent to which we farm out investment portfolios to outside organizations?
In terms of overall complexity, or I'm not sure I understand. You just want to understand information in terms of funds that have primarily managed the money in-house versus funds that farm out management of the fund? Is that what you're
saying?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Okay. Thank you. I understand that Minnesota farms out the majority of our investment funds to outside organizations.
Correct.
And my question is, to what extent does that kind of comparison play into your study, or did you look at those kinds
we
of comparisons?
We did look at those types of things. And during the interview session when we learned more from Howard and his team about how they manage the assets, it's clearly that staff is driving a lot of the investment decisions. So whether and that involves lots of different things other than just farming out some of the money or choosing to manage some of the money in-house. The overall asset in terms of asset allocation and doing tactical shifts and things that are really going to add value to the various funds that they manage. Those things are equal. You know, those things are very important into driving a high performing fund. So we also take those things into account when we're making an assessment of how sophisticated or complex the investment program is.
One just follow up, Mr. Chairman. How does Minnesota compare in terms of the extent to which it farms out with the peer groups that you looked at?
The peer group, it's consistent. It's consistent with the peers. Some choose to manage more the assets in-house, and that's a lot. That's a function, you know, some of the very largest funds. But most have a similar structure in the sense that they'll choose to manage certain assets in-house because it's more cost-effective, typically around indexing equities or managing fixed income assets. Minnesota's program looks very similar to others, but just recognize the fact that other fund structures, they vary a lot. There's no one model that's the best model.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any further questions on this area?
Mr. Chairman, area? May I add some comments to what he was asking about?
I think you're going to win here. Yeah, but you can.
I just real quick.
Unless you want to, yeah, go ahead. I'm not trying to.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Lanning, we also have other firms that we do comparisons with. Like we have benchmarking firms. We do benchmarking as far as what's our administrative cost versus other funds. What's the cost as far as helping our constituents or community service or other. Job titles and roles within our organization. So we have other groups that do that kind of service for us. Mm-hmm. To your first comment about comparisons of salaries and things, when you compare And this relates back to what Representative De La Force was asking about. When you look at how we're paid in Minnesota compared to the other states we compare to, a lot of those states give bonuses, and a lot of them have health care built in. And those are some things that we could look at down the road for Minnesota. But right now, we're strictly concerned about the salary of our executive directors and how they compare. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the SER 3 amendment or resolution. I'm sorry.
Further discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I do have a question about it. Does the motion has number 2 instruct staff to prepare legislation necessary? So do we have to then pass legislation to implement what we're doing here then, or this is beyond what we can do here at this subcommittee? What legislation are we needed?
That's a good question. I thought we kind of ratified today what we did legislatively in 383 last session, but maybe I'm...
Mr. Chair, what the legislature did during the 2008 session was to change the ranges for these positions, and what the subcommittee is being asked today is to increase the actual salaries within that range.
Mr. Chair, what legislation do we need then?
Why do we have to go back is what he's asking. On the bottom here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzel, by law, the actions of the subcommittee have to be ratified by the full legislature.
Yeah, gotcha. Right. Okay.
Then it'll be retroactive.
Well, we just can't do our own thing here. Huh? We have to get approval from somebody else. All right, you've heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion prevails. Mr. Hansen, what you got about 5 or 10 minutes, a short, I think without objection, we'll let Mr. Hansen give us an update on the merger with the Department of Finance and the Department of Employee Relations without objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Get you on
I did
your
have
way.
A handout as well.
A handout.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Tom Hansen. I'm the Commissioner of Finance and Employee Relations. And I just wanted to take a few minutes to talk to you a little bit and remind you that we did merge, the old finance merged with old DOOR. And it was in legislation in the 2007 session, and I believe it passed unanimously. And we have been over the last year going through a merger process. We began with our IT functions in the two agencies merging around Christmas. And what's not commonly known is that we're one of the finance and employee relations is now one of the larger computer operations in state government. We manage the accounting and procurement system, which touches every agency, as well as the Semaphore system, which is the human resources system. Everybody, all employees plug their time cards in, and it's the system that makes sure not only your employees, but the legislative branch, but our executive branch employees get paid. We have combined the business units of DOOR into finance by June 1st, and that includes Mr. Larson's labor relations unit, Mr. Morocco's, who's sitting behind me, CGIP program, as well as human resources management. The other big change that we are going through, for those that have been to the Centennial Building, the big barge-like building down the road, we are taking our agency from 2 floors down to 1.5 floors. And I never realized how much rent you can actually save by vacating half of a floor in a building, but we should save about $200,000 to $250,000. So. And some of that is making our cubicles smaller. We are also going to, by reorganization order, move the Management and Analysis Division from the Department of Admin to the Department of Finance and Employee Relations. And the current director of that unit, Judy Plant, will be promoted to Assistant Commissioner overseeing the CGIP and Human Resources Management areas. And we're in the market for a new name. So if you have any ideas, our fur name is, as you can tell, is probably just temporary. And yes, Senator Shy, that's true. And we are in the, we're going to be focusing on workforce planning, compensation, and how we can better utilize our resources.
Fine, Emory.
Mr. Chairman, that's all I had.
Fine.
We've been through them all. There's not a good one.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, every time the Centennial Building is mentioned, it jogs my mind into history. I worked for the Department of Education back in the 60s, and virtually all of state government was in the Centennial Building. There was one floor for Department of Taxation taxes.
That's right.
There was one for conservation.
Sure.
One for education and one for public welfare. We still had the highway building, and there's a couple other things wandering around, but that was all the main functions were right there. One floor each, and now yours has got 1.5 floors.
Four and a half. It's a real treat. Come by.
All right. Well, I think that's – thank you for the
– thank you.
Update. We'll get back now to number five, the review of amendments to the State Board of Investment and Salary Administration. Let me say that on page five, there's a statement by me, which I'm retracting, where we're going to do this at another meeting. I've talked to some of the members, and we've had time now to review everything. I thought it was a little too quick, a little too fast, but I've been convinced that at least in my mind, that that's the right thing to do. So I'm withdrawing my statement kind of right at the end of the page three where we're not going to do it today, unless, of course, it's the majority of the body that will decide. But I'm taking away my objection to waiting. Okay? All right, let's go. But that doesn't mean, of course, there always could be a motion to say, let's wait. So, that's...
So Dorr has reviewed it.
Yeah. And the governor and others are all on board. And apparently the governor even mentioned it today on CCO Radio, and so you get a lot of support here, it sounds like, lately. Go ahead. Who's first? Lori Hacking, Teachers Retirement Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here on behalf not just of TRA, but also the other two retirement systems, PARA and MSRS, to urge you to adopt this compensation proposal that's before you. We believe it's critically important to the continued success of our investment program. With me today are two individuals. Judith Maris is the Chief Investment Officer for Alliant Tech Systems, and is also a member, longstanding member of the Investment Advisory Committee, and chairs our Alternative Investments Subcommittee. And Chris Murphy, I believe you've already met, is the author of the study that you've had a chance to review, hopefully. I do want to stress that this proposal has been unanimously voted on by the governor, by the State Board of Investment, which includes the four constitutional officers, the governor, state auditor, who is actually present here to indicate her support, the Secretary of State, and Attorney General. Those four constitutional officers are fiduciaries for the pension funds and for the State Board of Investment, and as their role are responsible, really, for those investments, and that's, I think, why they have endorsed this plan. Just a little background on this. Some of you have heard our we've been able to meet with you, but we lost our deputy or assistant executive director in the spring, and he was sort of the logical successor to Howard Bicker, the director, when he retires. Mr. Perry, the deputy, left to join the Maryland State Retirement System as their CIO, and their compensation levels more than double if you include the bonus that he is eligible for. So a huge differential between our pay levels and those of other large systems. And I might add, Maryland is actually a smaller system. It's only a $40 billion system. With Mr. Perry's departure, we felt SBI was in danger of having no succession plan. and we really came to understand that the pay levels for that deputy position were so low and non-competitive that we would not be able to attract the experience and expertise that we really need for that position. So out of concern for Mr. Perry's departure and the high turnover that we have been experiencing at SBI, we've lost 14 investment professionals in 10 years, and that's out of a very small staff of only about 12. The three retirement boards passed a resolution asking for a compensation study. That study was done, and as you can see from the results, our pay levels at SBI are anywhere from 19% to 45% below the median of other large public systems. The study recommended that we bring up the compensation levels to at least the median of other large pension systems. The Investment Advisory Council endorsed the study, and then, of course, the SBI voted in favor of it on June 20th. I want to point out and emphasize that the increased costs related to this proposal would be pretty much largely borne by the pension systems, not the general fund. Just a final point, I want to kind of put this in financial perspective. The State Board manages $60 billion in assets, making it one of the largest in the United States of a pension system. Its program is very complex. It demands a high-level expertise, particularly in alternative investments, which include private equity and venture capital. Compared to other large pension systems, our returns have been excellent. We frequently rank in the top quartile or top third among other systems, and in fact have been able to garner over an 11% per year return for the past 25 years. So that's quite a degree of success. 70% of the revenue to support the pension systems comes from investment returns. So it's absolutely critical that we have a successful program and continue on that path. So with that, we would really appreciate your support, and this is a critical issue. And Ms. Maris is available to speak for the Investment Advisory Committee, and if you have any questions or would like to hear a presentation on the McLaughlin study, we're at your pleasure.
I think we've all had in our hands now for 8 or 10 days or something this report, and I think all the members have hopefully had a chance to look at it. So.
Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Senator Betzel.
I think to stress the importance is the board manages is over $50 billion? $60 billion.
It's actually 60. About 50 in pension fund assets, and when you other include all the others, 60. The state general fund and other responsibilities that the board has, it's 60.
Which is, when you consider the general fund that we deal with, and what they have to deal with on the investments, it's a lot of money.
It's real money.
Yes, it is. So, and Mr. Chair, clearly the people who have to make these decisions, you know, we need top-notch people doing that because, boy, the consequences, especially when we have the market being as it is today, you know, have to know what they're doing. Otherwise, you know, there are errors can multiply and cost us dearly down the road. So, you know, I think we support the proposal.
Senator Wergen and Betzel, are you both on the pensions commissioner?
Yeah.
And you understand, I don't know if anybody else is, but I would say that just firsthand, you guys are right there in the trenches and know what these people do. I mean, most of us kind of know what they're doing, but you're right there at all the meetings, so.
Chairman. They're responsible for making or recommending the decisions that can muck it up from our end. I think the investment Board of Investment has done it.
Everybody.
I've always been amazed at the kind of return that they do. I wish, yeah. You know.
And we have to.
I'd rather have most of my personal investments in their hands than where they are.
Well, they're huge numbers, and we need certainly competent people or these are small numbers compared to, you know, what they're doing over there. But Representative De La Forest, Lanning, Lilly, Bingham. So we've got, unless you want to hear more, we've got, we
redid a motion here. We don't have a blue sheet on it, but Mr. Hubinger can read it, if you will.
Mr. Chair and members, the motion would be to approve the salary administration plan submitted by the State Board of Investment to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations on July 3rd, 2008, and then second, to authorize the director to implement the plan, and third, to instruct staff to prepare legislation necessary for final enactment of the plan.
Mr. Chair, I would move that.
Senator Workin. Okay, further discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I've been reading and looking, and I may have momentarily missed somebody saying it's not the intention to go right to the top of this. You know, there's been a couple of newspaper articles about it, and I would say that I thought the governor chose his words carefully this morning, actually. He didn't wholeheartedly endorse it, but he said, yes, he realized that we need to better compensate people who are responsible, but he kind of modified it some way, and I thought, I just don't want it, because it's a dramatic increase and it's very much needed, and I strongly support it. I just wanted to clarify that it's not the intention to go to the maximum at this point, and you're talking about the midpoint. Is that right, Ms. Hackett?
Excellent question, Senator Scheid. I think it is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, yes, the State Board, with respect to the director's position, Howard's position, and he's been in it for over 25 years, the recommendation is to be at the median. And then the state...
Midpoint.
Good. Yeah, that's...
The Howard, as director, then has authority to place others on his staff within those ranges, and will do that based on experience level. Because, as you may have heard yesterday, he has some junior members, you know, who would make more sense to put them in the lower end of the spectrum. So it'll be done based on experience.
Thank you.
Senator Workin?
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, I think it plays a role in it, too, that in some respects, in some offices in state government and local units of government, it's okay that we have positions that are sort of a training ground, you might say, and that people move on from there, for instance, into the private sector or something like that. But this particular area isn't something we can afford to be a training ground in. This is something where we have to recruit the best, because the repercussions are for the entire state. And the smallest error in judgment makes a huge difference to all the citizens. And if these pension funds wind up in trouble and short, we know that all the taxpayers end up paying the price. And so we can't afford these positions to be a training ground. These positions have to be the premier people that protect the citizens of the whole state.
So well spoken. Yeah, we don't need training wheels in this area. Okay, well,
made the motion.
Senator Workin made the motion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Update on the State Employment Group Insurance Program. Nathan Morocco?
Yes. Hello, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm here to provide some updates on the State Employee Group Insurance Program. And as I understand, there's two areas of interest that the committee had, one related to the health assessment and the second related to the implementation of our single PBM. So with that, I'll go ahead and just provide actually, I have a handout that I think could be helpful. Some of you have probably seen this. This was some information, I guess, just for the record. My name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division, and I do oversee the CEGIT program. And then to my left is Stephen Berkland, who oversees our Risk Management Division, which is essentially responsible for implementing and the health assessment that we'll be discussing. So what I thought I'd do is just provide some brief background on the health assessment, and then stand back with Mr. Berkland's assistant on any questions that you might have. I think this one-page document, again, this was something that we had provided during session to you folks. I'll just cover some key highlights on it, and then and we can go from there. The assessment, as a point of background, was implemented in 2005. It's a benefit negotiated between the executive branch and the unions representing the state employees, and we have bargained this benefit for two rounds now. The purpose of the personal health assessment is to help employees understand their current health status and what they could do to become healthier. Really, the PHA is there to help define the wellness of our individual employees. It's a survey that asks a series of questions about health and lifestyle and health history, and it's really based on research about what modifiable factors might lead to serious medical problems in the future, and that really is the goal of the health assessment. It's about trying to identify the risk factors that are out there before someone enters into later stages of a specific disease. The assessment only identifies health factors that can be addressed through behavior changes, so we're talking about modifiable behaviors here. We have other tools that are in place that are there to capture that will trigger other types of initiatives that we have, whether it be on disease management programs or case management programs that we might look through claims data or other types of sources of information. Again, because this is really to identify diseases that haven't occurred yet, that's why we need to go to the members and just ask them about their lifestyle so that we can try to present to them some useful information that might help them prevent these diseases. But this is not information that's likely to be in any kind of doctor's chart because, again, it hasn't been diagnosed yet. And so while some employees are very conscious about their health, in fact, most people who develop preventable chronic health problems didn't know that they were on this trajectory, and that's really what we're trying to prevent here. The personal health assessment really has become a fairly common tool in the market. I think at the time that we had implemented it and even started talking about it, we were probably on the forefront of this issue, but it really has become pretty commonplace. Just as some examples of other entities that are using this, the University of Minnesota, all Twin Cities metro area counties are using it, Target, General Mills, Wells Fargo, Fairview Health Systems. It's quite an extensive list. It's about 60% of the Fortune 500 companies are using health assessment as a tool. And while some employers have made it a mandatory part, meaning you have to take the health assessment in order to participate, we chose more of a voluntary approach on this where we wanted to provide some incentive to encourage people to take it, but by no means did we want to absolutely require it as a necessity to participate. Healthcare policy experts really have, I think, widely accepted the health assessment as a valid tool. You may recall, for those of you who are following healthcare reform this year, both the Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access and the Governor's Transformation Task Force recommended that all state citizens take a health assessment as kind of a key cornerstone to healthcare reform. In terms of the health assessment foretelling the future, what it's trying to do is identify the individual's risk factors and provide an opportunity to change or prevent or at least at a minimum delay the disease. This is really important because 70% of the total disease burden that we as a group and really every insurance group out there, 70% of the disease burden really is based on risk factors that are modifiable. So that means, there are some things that are just unpreventable. Some people have a good mix of genes and other people don't. But in terms of what you can actually control, it really is about 70% of the risk disease burden that's out there. And the three leading causes, underlying causes of death in the United States are tobacco use, diet, and inactivity. I don't think that comes as a surprise, but I think on a day-to-day basis, we don't think about that. I think when we talk about healthcare and we say those are the top three, I don't think that surprises any of us. But really what the risk assessment is attempting to do is just kind of, again, it's to reinforce that message. The other most common underlying causes of death are alcohol, firearm, illicit drug use, and motor vehicle injuries. So, again, these are all things. If you have taken the health assessment yourself, you may recall some questions related to these particular issues. In terms of the personal health assessment as a benefit, as a bargain benefit, the employees have the option to take the personal health assessment. Those who voluntarily choose to take the assessment and agree to the follow-up coaching that's a part of the health assessment receive a $5 discount on the office visit copay. So essentially, this is voluntary. Employees who choose not to take the health assessment just simply pay the negotiated copay. So I think our current level is $22. That's the negotiated copay, but if you take the health assessment, it's $17. So that's the incentive and reward that we try to offer. And I believe we get about 70% participation with that reward system in place. If the individual's health report indicates a significant risk and the employees agree to the coaching, then the coach will invite them, him or her, to consult about ways to improve their potential outcomes here. The health coaches provide them with information, resources specific to their individual health risk, and they discuss the results, talk through the options, and answer the questions. The employee at any time can drop out of the coaching program. In fact, even after taking the health assessment, if they decide that they really don't want to engage in coaching at all, they can simply let the health coach know that they're not interested in that, and that's it. They fulfill their obligation. They'll get the $5 reduction in copay, and that's all that's necessary on their behalf. For members that do want to engage in it and perhaps somewhere down the line feel as though it's they have what they need, they can simply drop at any time and they'll still continue to receive the $5 reduced copay off of visit copay. Some examples of where this might tie in, if someone indicates that they're a smoker, we have excellent smoking cessation programs. So we will provide all the drugs, all the expenses related to smoking cessation, whether it's the patch or the pills, or anything else, we will waive that. So, it's a fantastic opportunity for someone who's willing to come forward and say, I am a smoker, to then tie that into the specific benefit design that we have. Because even though it is part of our bargain benefits, this smoking cessation program, not all employees are aware of that particular component. So to be able to pull those two things together and really provide, I think, a tremendous benefit to the employee, all at no cost to them, for those who want to quit, it's a good opportunity for us to place that benefit in front of them. In terms of taking the assessment upon completion, upon completion of the personal health assessment, they do receive a personal confidential results and programming resources that can address their specific risks. Just to wrap up on a couple other things, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. I wanted to touch base a little bit about data privacy and how these health assessments function. Essentially, as an employer group, we do not have access to any specific data related to the questionnaires on a particular employee. What we do receive are some aggregate numbers. So we can tell you that, 18% of all state employees are smokers, but we don't know which particular members are, and that's not the goal for us as a program on the health assessment. As a program, we like to know sort of what are the general trends for us out there so that we can, through the bargaining process, we can tailor the programs that we think will be more beneficial. Again, with the example with the smoking cessation, if there's a high prevalence of smoking out there, then offering a smoking cessation program really works. If we didn't have a high smoking population, it really wouldn't be a benefit that would be useful to our group, and we would probably try to focus on some other area. In terms of the data, we as an employer group, we don't host the system. We don't host the survey. This is done through third-party vendors. And, of course, they would be subject, and we are subject to all the state and federal laws, the HIPAA laws that protect this information. And so really it's up to a member if they want to share this information. Certainly they can do that. This is a printable report that they can take to their doctor, and the doctor can go over it and explain to them what do these results mean to them and what are some things that the doctor could recommend as a result of the findings. But it really is up to them. So if they want to hang on to it, if they just simply want to let it exist as a PDF file that maybe they reference from time to time, that's fine. That's their decision. But we as an employer do not have any of that information. And really, the data privacy is critical to our success and the success of the personal health assessment. If employees don't trust the system, if they don't trust the employer, And if they don't trust that, that we have maintained a firewall between the data that they're providing and us as an organization, you know, they would simply stop taking it, and I think it would lose its usefulness. So really, we have every vested interest to want to keep this data private for our members so that they feel comfortable with it. So really, I guess with that, I'd just like to kind of to close on sort of the financial aspect of the personal health assessment. There are studies that show that the personal health assessment is a valuable tool. We know that that this is going to improve quality for our members. Even if there was a cost and no direct cost savings to the program, we know that it would be improving quality because for even if there was a handful of people that became more aware of their disease potential, that would improve the quality of their life. If we could prevent disease, if we could prevent chronic illness from occurring, certainly we would argue that's a quality enhancement. But there are some studies out there that have shown direct cost-benefit analysis to the personal health assessment. As an example, a study in health promotion programs for Medicare beneficiaries found that those completing the PHA saved the plan somewhere between $100 and $650 per person per year. And so what we would hope is that we would see similar results. But the health assessment for us is fairly new. And when you're in the realm of trying to prevent disease and diseases that may be 5, 10, 15 years out, it's the health assessment that we're offering today that's going to save that money 15 years from now. We will know that 15 years from now, but as a sitting here today, I can't quantify the exact savings. What I can tell you is that we do have staff, and this would fall under Mr. Berkland's area. We do have a epidemiologist on staff that is looking at this data today. We really have about 1 year's worth of good data, and I say that because even though the health assessment has been around for 3 years, the requirement for the follow-up coaching was only a requirement within the last year. And, this is the personal health assessment is sort of a live and learn process for us. And one of the things that we did realize or suspect was that although we feel that the personal health assessment tool is valuable, the tool without the connection to the follow-up coaching probably didn't have the value that we would have originally hoped with the tool all on its own. So while we do think that the health coaching is extremely important component to the personal health assessment, again, we didn't make it a requirement, but our hope was that most people would do the follow-up coaching, and we are seeing that the majority of folks who took the assessment did agree to the follow-up coach, and that's only been within the last year. So we're hoping that we can start to look at some of the numbers, and we're very optimistic that we will be very typical to the Medicare population, saving somewhere between $100 to $600 per person per year. Perhaps a year from now I can come to you with very specific information. So with that, I guess I will answer any questions that you may have.
Nice report, Mr. Rocco. Senator Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't disagree with the concept of the survey, but when you come here and you admit that as long as they fill out the survey and then they can disregard the coaching, they still get the cost benefit or the reduction. For the 2 years, nearly 2 years that I've been on this committee, we've asked. I know that Representative De La Forest, Representative Hillstrom, I know some of the senators have asked for the direct cost-benefit analysis, and for 3 years we've received nothing about it, at least from your predecessor, and that would come here and testify. And if there's studies, I would like to see them. And I understand that it's kind of a newer program within the 3 years, and I know you just said that maybe in a year you'll be able to come here and give us a more direct benefit. But I don't understand that according to our health plan, and I went and had my physical this week and got a clean bill of health too, so we'll be around together for a long time there, De La Forest, if I didn't get a clean bill of health, I can disregard all of that and healthcare costs go up. And I guess what I don't understand is I didn't do that over phone after filling out a survey. I did it because my health insurance gives me a free, without having to pay a copay at the doctor's office, for a physical. And then I sit down face-to-face with a doctor that I know, that I trust, that knows my history, and can sit with me and work through things, make recommendations of where I have to go. I think that is a heck of a lot more beneficial, and I would say it'd probably be more financially beneficial to people versus somebody on a phone that if they start asking me questions, I could just hang up on. and I don't understand why maybe the program, I could see the benefits, but I think it needs some tweaking, that maybe instead of the first phone call of a coach, that maybe I don't understand why we can't be using that free annual physical to start the process and then move to a more cost-effective mechanism like a phone. Because I understand that if I had health problems and I had to keep going to a doctor every month, that's going to start adding up on a healthcare system in general. But I guess I don't see the cost-benefit of it when people sign up for the $5 deduction and then they don't participate in the program. And this is the first year I didn't do it because, I just didn't see the benefit of it. So I don't know. I don't know if there's a question in there or if that's just a general frustration or observation. But I would like to see the studies that you're talking about. And I hope that in a year you come back and tell us about the cost-benefit analysis. Because if 70% of people are participating in it, then there obviously should be some data out there that show the cost savings of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, I would be happy to send you specific links to the studies. I think in terms of just a response to that, what we're trying to do is really take a multi-pronged approach to this. What works well for some people in terms of engaging them in their health care doesn't necessarily work well for others. So if you think about the health assessment, it's an online tool. There's no one else in the room. You get to talk to a computer. And for some folks who don't necessarily want to tell a doctor that they're depressed or about other conditions that they might have, a tool where it's just them and the computer and no one else knows might be of value. But for others that, just in the realm of learning, where some people prefer to read and some people prefer to see things and some people prefer to listen to things, that's sort of what we're trying to do in healthcare is we're trying to find the mechanism that helps people get engaged. So with the online tool, again, it's a one-on-one interaction with the person in the computer. With the follow-up coaching, now you've got someone that you can talk to on the phone. And for some people, maybe that's the approach that they like. They don't necessarily want to talk to someone. They also don't want to just have a computer blasting some information in there. They want to have that phone conversation. That works for them, might not work for others. And I think for you, Representative Bingham, it's absolutely appropriate. If you have a doctor that you're very confident in and want to share this information, we think that's an excellent resource for you and folks like you. Take the health assessment, bring it to your doctor, and talk to him about it. I'm not sure, really, again, we're trying to cover a broad spectrum of modifiable behaviors. I'm not sure that a doctor during a physical would talk about things like driving habits or maybe would be very specific about the kinds of things that the health assessment might be trying to get at. Certainly doing a routine physical is very important, and we encourage all our members to do that by providing that as a free service. But so I guess that would be my comment would be just that we're trying to take a multi-pronged approach on it.
Senator Bingham, Representative Bingham, did you have a follow-up?
Yep, just a follow-up comment. I guess what, and I'm not going to get into prolonged discussion or debate about this. We did have one on the floor of the House last year about this program. But I don't, and again, this is just maybe a difference of opinion, but I don't get how somebody who's not comfortable going to a doctor is going to put information into a computer for who knows what to see to maybe do something with it. Or if they decide to do something with it, talk to a complete stranger on a phone and be giving accurate information. So I'm not going to get in a debate about it with you, but I would like to see the cost benefit. And I hope that if you come back here in a year, there is some.
Okay, Senator Scheid, De La Forest, and Olson, then I think we're gonna try to get out of here.
Well,
we had from 9
Mr. Chairman,
to,
and 10 I 30. Have to go to another job, actually.
Yeah,
so.
some people have a job.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen,
am one of the people that thinks this is a really good idea. I don't think we've had a discussion in the Senate about it, and I know that Representative Hillstrom, who represents part of the district that I represent, had issues, and I think that some of the issues relate to actually the dynamic between the person doing the interviewing and the person. And so I don't know that you can control that. But, you know, I wanted to suggest just that I think that if we required everybody to have the yearly physical, maybe then that would be a good idea. But I suspect there are a good many people, even in this room, probably the majority of this room, whose gender does not generally get themselves to a doctor when they ought to, just statistically speaking, not anybody in particular, but, you know, I think Representative De La Forest may be an exception here. No, I'm teasing, but, I mean, the truth of the matter is that an awful lot of people just don't even do, they may not use the benefit that they have. And so I just wanted to, I'm interested about the 70% participation. You said that. Do you get an idea, Mr. Morocco, do you get any numbers about how many people do smoke and have quit? I don't mean data on that person, just kind of aggregate numbers, or how many people hadn't done anything about potential diabetes but then did start using, you know, the therapies that are there for that, for the treatment of that? Do you have those kind of?
You know, we do, but I'm actually going to have Mr. Berkland yep. answer that. He's closer to the data than I am.
Sir.
I could even defer to another person who's in the room from our pharmacy benefit management company, because we can tell you that there are thousands and thousands of unique prescriptions for drug to help people quit smoking every month, actually. And so we can tell you, just overall, we can tell you that the number of people in the state government who report that they smoke or use tobacco products is less than the state average. That's a positive. Mm-hmm. However, compared to the number of people who smoke and the number of people who are, I would say probably 90% who report that they smoke or use tobacco, these are from these aggregate reports, report that about 90% of them say that they're very ready to quit and would like to quit or are engaged in some effort to try to quit. And so that's why prompted us to then waive the copay on nicotine replacement products for those members and provide free programs, support, and so on. And we do get reports from the health insurance carriers that administer our benefits on how many, just the number who are in these programs and how many have prescriptions for these medications and so on. And it's actually impressive. Each year, increasing numbers of people are trying to quit smoking.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask about the assessment itself. Is it something that's kind of just a uniform tool used by those private companies and other government entities, or is it something that CGIP developed, the one that's used?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, we do rely on the folks that administer it to create the questionnaire, and they have the algorithms and the programs in place that they want to match up. So they're asking the questions in the best way that they think is appropriate to match them to the right programs.
So then, Mr. Chairman, and I'll finish with this. I would the health plan. So, yeah, the different health plans who administer it. But I have a suggestion, and then I'd like to see you make to them in the survey, and that is, it seems to me they should be asking people if they have an existing health condition that might affect their diet or their exercise or whatever. There are a lot of people in my age group who are dealing with, you know, some serious health conditions, and they never touch on that. It kind of looked like I was in really good health when I got through, and I actually am, But, you know, there's little details that, like cancer or diabetes or those kinds of things. Well, I think maybe they do check for that, but for the diabetes. But anyway, it seems to me they should be asking about, do you have any existing health condition that might have an impact? And perhaps then diet, you can turn that around, and then particular diet may be helpful to a person who has cancer, for example, who has had, and be sure that people are doing the right, getting the right kind of follow-up treatment for the, those conditions. Just with the aging of the population, and I think our state employee group is also aging as well, kind of reflective of the population as a whole, that that's something that you might consider that needs to be asked. But I support strongly the idea of the assessment.
So, Representative DeLaForest.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I had just a couple very brief questions. Mr. Morocco, what are your input costs for this program? What does it cost the state to operate this assessment program each year?
Approximately $1 million.
Okay. And then, of course, Mr. Chairman, that will be part of the cost-benefit analysis that we'll receive in, at some point in the future. Mr. Chairman, I had one other question. Mr. Morocco, when you look at your universe of folks who agree to take this assessment, what assumptions do you make with respect to the veracity of the answers that people give when they're asked questions like, do you have guns in the home and the like, or do you smoke? What are your assumptions?
Mr. Chair and Representative De La Forest, our assumptions is that the members that want to know more about their health care will answer the questions truthfully, and there will be a certain segment of the population that will take the health assessment strictly to get the $5 reduction in copay and probably try to answer in a way that will not generate the necessity for any follow-up coaching calls. In terms of what percentage is that, we haven't delved into is it that 20%, 30%. You know, I think just to add to that, certainly as Stephen mentioned, I think one of our goals when we compare ourselves to the state in terms of let's say smoking, if we're less than the state average, then it would really be our goal to try and figure out, to your point, is that because people are being deceptive, or is that because we have programs in place that are being as effective as we hope?
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Morocco, that's a point. Anecdotally, everybody around this table knows there's a segment of folks out there who are being less than truthful with their responses, and because you're giving them a mixed motive. I mean, really, I think the average employee will take the survey to control their health care costs. And I think that's an issue, and that's a policy matter that can be debated for folks next session without me. But I've always had a trouble with punishing folks for not answering the survey, and I do think you're providing a mixed motive there. And as a matter of fact, I think the primary motive for a lot of folks is to control their health care costs as opposed to tell the computer how often they're engaged in behavior that their neighbors may condemn, whereas I'm with Bigham, I think they'd be more inclined to tell their doctor that within the confines of the doctor-patient relationship. Not an online one. Mr. Chairman, thanks.
You're welcome. Senator Olson, then that's it for this morning.
Chairman, you
have questions.
I just had a comment. I, after a year of rebellion and not doing it, I did do it this last year, but I don't recall that I've received any health score or personal report or health tips. Much less a call, and I think I even agreed to coaching just to see what they were talking about.
Mr. Chair, what would happen?
Would it have come by computer and I've somehow just not managed to turn it on?
No, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, actually only about a third of the responses warrant a follow-up call. So at the completion of your personal health assessment, you would have had immediate access to the results, and that is stored in the system for you to access at any time. You can log back in.
Pay any attention to it. Okay.
Yeah, so if you want to see the report, you can. And you obviously are based on your responses, are healthy enough or didn't trigger any of the algorithms that would have generated a follow-up coaching call.
Didn't trigger, yes. Nothing we can do. Thank you.
Okay, apparently, there's some more discussion. I have to leave. Before I leave, I'd like to just acknowledge Representative De La Forest for his work on this commission, and
I said, we might have another meeting or two, so it's not like you're totally out of here. But
still welcome.
I know you've been a good servant for your district there, and appreciate your work on this commission. And you and I've been on a couple of conference committees to do it together, and we get along, don't we?
Right, and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, especially coming from you. As you know, we've had an opportunity to work together, and I've got a great deal of respect for your leadership and what you've done managing. You serving your district as well. I've respected your history of public service, and yours is going to move on. So look forward to reviewing it from afar.
And, of course, my dear, dear friend and minority assistant minority leader, Senator Worgan, is moving on to a very important position with the PUC. And quite frankly, right lately they've had a lot of things going on over there, so you're going to be working pretty hard. But we congratulate you on your promotion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Mr. President, whichever, but you have been a joy to serve with, I will tell you.
We've had some good times. I've got another meeting. You've got another meeting, but I hope you stick around because there's some pharmacy questions that Representative Bigham is going to be visiting about and others. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that... there had been some concerns, especially from a staff perspective, about the prescription drug program. And I would first like to see if Ms. Cashman would come up and discuss some of the issues that have been going on. And between the two of you, if you want to decide who wants to go first and whoever else is going to talk on the subject, but I know that I have some concerns about this, too, and I guess I can make some comments after the fact. But
I'm Kelly Knight. I'm the director.
Sorry, it's all right.
Ms. Knight. I'm the director of human resources for the House of Representatives. And for about the past 6 months since the transition from our carriers providing our pharmacy benefit to our new PBM, Navitus, I've been expressing some concerns, and I've expressed concerns to Mr. Hubinger, and then upon finding out about this meeting, Representative Bigham had suggested that I come forward. I want to give a little history. Navitus is now our pharmacy provider, our PBM, and instead of getting our drugs through Health Partners, Blue Cross Blue Shield, our preferred one, we now have a pharmacy card. And this was a big change for employees. And during the transition, we were told that this was going to save the state of Minnesota a tremendous amount of money, which obviously I do not disagree with that because I believe saving the money wherever we can is viable to the health of our overall insurance program. And one of the primary things that we were also told was if a drug was not going to be covered any longer, if an insured was on a drug, they would receive some notice from the pharmacy manager, and that in turn they would be given an appropriate period of time to be able to then go take that letter, go to their doctor, and have a discussion about a possible generic and whether or not that generic would be appropriate. Unfortunately, in the transition, our previous providers did not provide Navitus with prescription histories. And at first, we thought this number to be relatively small. And when I contacted Door as well as Navitus, I was told, let's wait this out because it's a transition period. We're going to experience some bumps in the road. And the one thing that I've always been told is an employee should never leave the pharmacy without their medication. If there's a problem, the pharmacist should call Navitus. And that was one of the things that was one of the fundamental pieces of this transition. And some of the problems that we have seen, and I raised these to Mr. Morocco and also to Navitus, and is that we've had a lack of notice to insured timely notice regarding changes in formularies. I have a letter that was received. The letter was dated June 13th, and it was regarding two drugs that would be where there was going to be changes to the formulary. And it said beginning April 1, 2008. Now, this letter was dated June 13th. And it said that they would be grandfathered at their current level until July 1. This gives an employee approximately a week to 2 weeks to be able to arrange an appointment, try out a generic, find out if it's medically appropriate. And, you know, this notice should have gone out back in April when the drug was actually changed. Since I raised this issue that I was coming here and also that I raised this issue to Mr. Morocco, this letter has now been pulled, and everyone that received this letter has been given now till October 1. But this, in my mind, we're seeing a number of issues along this type with the correspondence. One of the missing course pieces of this letter is that there's nothing in here that clearly states to the employee what they are supposed to do if they and their physician have perhaps already tried a generic and that pharmacy history has not gone over to Navitus. There's nothing in here that clearly tells them what they are to do. And I can tell you that I have received a number of panicked visits from House employees, as well as some from the Legislative Coordinating Commission, who are on drugs when they've tried the generics don't work, and now they are holding a letter saying it's no longer covered. And in all those cases, when I have approached Navitus and Dewar, it's been resolved. Because the simple answer is that if your doctor believes that in turn this is the only medication, that the generic does not work for you, then they need to send the documentation to Navitus. Unfortunately, that's not clearly stated in here. And so I think it leaves a number of employees feeling very concerned. One of the other examples that, you know, in the interest of time, I'll share one with you where I have a significant concern is we happen to have, the House did, an employee whose spouse was on Prozac. Never received notice that that drug was not going to be covered. When I contacted Navitus, I was told we do not cover Prozac under any circumstances. And I said, well, in this particular instance, the employee's spouse has tried the generic. The generic does not work, and as a matter of fact, the employee's spouse became suicidal when they tried to go to the generic. Now, it was my understanding that the Prozac would be granted, that there would be some sort of grandfathering in here. When the employee went to pick up the medication, I received a phone call from the spouse saying, I realize our insurance benefits were going to change and copays were going to change. However, I think $1,300 for a copay, which is the full cost of the drug, is a bit excessive. When I contacted Navitus, they agreed to give a 30-day waiver. Now, luckily, this employee's spouse had already tried the generic. All they had to do was get in contact with the medical practitioner and request that the information be sent to Navitus in order to get a waiver. Anyone who's had any experience getting an appointment with a medical health professional or a mental health professional knows it's not easy. I just had one employee who got an appointment with their psychiatrist 6 months out. And so a 30-day grace period would mean little, if anything, to an employee in that situation. Also, most mental health drugs take anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks to develop at such a level where they can be deemed whether or not they're effective or not. Now, we've always been able to work through each situation and resolve it. So for those people who've come to me, we've got it resolved. There's been a happy ending. People have received their drugs. But my concern is that once I was told by Navitus that they did not receive prescription histories on a large number, and that's a direct quote, of members of the state employees group insurance plan. What are we going to do? It now becomes our problem. How do we get in contact with these people? Because in my mind, these issues are going to continue to occur. And at least from our standpoint, did continue to occur. I even offered at that point in time, in the interest of time, and just because I had everyone here for session, to send a housewide email to all my members and staff saying that prescription histories, regardless of whose fault it was, who was supposed to do what, they were not received. So there's one or two reasons why we didn't receive a health history on you. One, you're not taking any medication. Or two, you are, and it just wasn't transferred. And if you are in the latter category, where you are taking drugs and there is no health history on you, encourage those people to contact Navitus, go through their drugs with the customer service people, and find out, am I one of these that's going to drop off the face of the earth? You know, am I going to lose coverage because I didn't receive a letter because there was no health history in order to, or prescription history, in order for me to be notified that I was going to lose my drug. So this has been, it's been a frustration because I think the issue is more systemic. I'm concerned about the employees that don't come to me that, for instance, look at this and say, well, I guess I just can't take this drug anymore, and aren't really having a conversation, a meaningful conversation with their doctor about, yes, I can take this drug if the generic doesn't work. And just hearing some of the health assessment conversation that has gone on, I think that that's a critical piece that ends up missing based on this correspondence. And one other concern that I've had is that there doesn't appear to be a vehicle to say, if there's something that we don't know, if we're making a judgment in a void based on data and based on, and not based on fact or additional input, it doesn't seem that there's a request for additional information. If someone calls, then they get that message. But in a mere letter, they do not. And this goes down to not only drugs, but the number of tablets a person can get of a particular drug. I mean, we've actually had an employee who, for chronic pain, is on a scheduled narcotic. The doctor determined that the person should be on two 20-milligram tabs versus one 40-milligram tab. Navitus, despite the pharmacist's request to go ahead and fill it, said the person was outside of the maximum number of tabs. But they could get the 40-milligram tabs, but they couldn't get the 220s at the number of tabs their doctor was requesting. They received a notice on March 26th after being to the pharmacist saying, we'll grandfather it, and we'll grandfather it until April 1. Which meant that they had approximately 5 days to get an appointment not only with their doctor but also schedule an appointment with the pain clinic in order to be able to find out if there's an alternative. And like I said, all these issues have gotten resolved, but I'm more concerned about systemic issues. Who are the people that are not coming to me? Who are the people that are just saying, well, I guess I'm going to have to make do, when in fact there is a vehicle for them to get their drugs?
Just for the sake of time, Mr. Morocco, if you care to respond to anything, and then we can open it up for questions. Thank you for your comments, too, Ms. Knight.
Sure. Actually, I think what I'd like to do, I'm not sure that we can respond to the specific cases that Mrs. Knight has mentioned, because obviously I don't have all the history on it. What I would like to do is just offer up that Mr. Radloff from Navitus make a couple broad comments, and then we can be here to answer questions for you. So with that,
if you'd state your name for the record and...
My name is Tom Radloff, and I'm the Director of Clinical Services for Navitus Health Solutions in Madison. I agree, and I'd like to talk about the letter first, because that's part of where a lot of the communication that we have going down. And if you read the end of the letter, at the very end, it says, if there are any questions about any of these, please call our customer service number. We will take care of everything for you. Unfortunately, what happens, and what I continue to tell people in the meetings, are don't leave until you call us. If there's an issue, call us. And unfortunately, the issues that Ms. Knight is coming up with are nobody ever called us. They go to you first, or they go to their employer first. And so they're, and I'm not saying that's the holy issue, and I agree with you, but I think what I'd like to represent is we as a customer care center and as a company, our whole goal is first call resolution, which means this call is resolved on that first phone call. We don't have to make multiple phone calls back. Does that happen all the time? Absolutely not. And are there gray issues in healthcare? Absolutely. And all of the decisions that we make as a company are all based on evidence. So we're looking at all of the evidence that's out there for you. So, the letters and the dating, I agree. A week later, we did send out a new letter with the new dates on it. I apologize for those letters for the formulary change that we did. We did notice that. Unfortunately, we noticed after the letter went out. So some of those are confusing issues, unfortunately, and we do have numbers, and we're there 24/7 for anybody to contact us if there are any questions. So, I can give you a brief history of the company. I'm not sure what you're looking for me, or I can just answer.
Does anybody want to know more about the company itself? Or my concern is that no one. Should be arriving at a pharmacy to find out that their pharmaceutical or the prescription drug that they have now all of a sudden is not covered,
right.
And there should be plenty of notice. And to expect someone to sit in a pharmacy on a phone before they leave is a little, my opinion, unrealistic. So I guess I'll open it up to any questions. Representative De La Forest.
I had a couple questions. Mr. Morocco, I think it'd be for you to refresh my memory. Is this a year-to-year contract, or what is the business relationship the state has with Novartis or whoever these people are?
Yeah, with Navitus.
Navitus.
Yes, Representative De La Forest. Essentially, we signed up with Navitus last year to implement a program for us effective 1-1 of this year. I believe it's a 5-year contract. With probably a 2-year guarantee with a renewal each year is I could double check that, but that's our typical arrangements with health plan administrators.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Morocco, or maybe a question for somebody else from Dewar. Overall, are you satisfied? I get the impression Ms. Knight is distinctly dissatisfied with Navitus. What's your assessment of the contract thus far?
Well, certainly the feedback that I've been getting from agencies around and from employees is that they're very happy with the service that Navitus is providing. Certainly, as the entity responsible for the implementation, we were realistic about the kinds of disruption that this was going to cause. Certainly, when you take three individual formularies and combine them into one, there's going to be changes. Prior to Navitus, each of the health plans, Health Partners, Blue Cross, and Preferred One, had their separate pharmacy manager and had different formulary rules. And so what we had was two employees sitting next to each other, and one had Blue Cross and one had Health Partners. With the exact same health conditions, one might be saying, I'm getting the drug, and the other one is saying, I'm not. Because, we as a program don't want to, we're not experts in pharmacy, and we don't want to manage a formulary to that level of degree. That's why we rely on these administrators. But obviously, when you get a group of experts together within each one of these entities, there could be some variances there. And so, really, that was the goal of going down to the single formulary, was so that we could better manage it, manage the expectations. And we recognized that with that was that there were going to be some bumps along the road. I think as Tom mentioned, things like the letter being misstated, that's clearly, I think it was an error that we're regretful of. But I don't think that represents the broader customer service that Navitas is bringing to our members. And certainly, I'd be happy to collect testimony from the other HR directors that have personally come up to me, or members that have come up to me and said, you know what, I did have an issue, but I will say that that the folks at the other end of the line at Navitas are really providing excellent customer service. So we recognize that issues are arising, but the feedback I'm getting is that the way that Navitas is resolving them is really satisfactory.
Madam Chair, thanks. One final question, maybe a statement. I would hope that there are some metrics in place, Mr. Morocco, for tracking these things. If you went to this new contract in the hope of making a more uniform system to better serve state employees, I would hope there are metrics in place to track how the employees are being treated vis-a-vis the new system versus the old system. What I'm trying to figure out here, and I feel like I'm in a vacuum of information, is the experience here of Ms. Knight. Is this typical of what's happening across state government, or did it just happen to be that a big batch of bad customer service happened to fall within her jurisdiction? That's what I'm trying to figure out, and I hope you have some, like I said, metrics in place, some methodology to track this to know whether or not you're receiving, that our state employees are receiving superior customer service going through this inconvenient change. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Does anybody know?
Well, sir, Representative De La Forest, certainly as the person responsible for the program, I think when HR directors such as Ms. Knight are helping their employees resolve the issues, if they are not getting resolved, they will eventually work themselves to me, and that's where Ms. Knight and myself have worked together to resolve some of these issues. So what I can tell you is kind of the person responsible, or at least experiencing the overall impact of the program and who's coming to me, and so I don't have a statistical analysis on it, but I can tell you that anecdotally I'm not hearing about the kinds of problems from other agencies that I'm hearing from Mrs. Knight. Now, that whether or not that's because her group is an anomaly and there happens to be a spike in some maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 real serious conditions and so we're more aware of it, or if in the other agencies it's getting resolved in a more effective manner, that I can't tell you. But I do meet with the HR directors on a monthly basis as part of a group convening all the HR directors within the agencies. And so, these kinds of issues are talked about, insurance issues are talked about as part of that meeting. And I'm getting very complimentary reviews from those other folks. But that's not to dismiss the issues that Mrs. Knight is having. They're very real, and they're there, and we're doing what we can to resolve them.
But
it does appear to be atypical.
Before Ms. Knight responds, there also has been situations where people are going from brand name prescription drugs down to generic without notification either, and just that can be just as, I mean, that you had that as an example, but that has happened, and I'm assuming that every time somebody has a problem, the first person they think of they're not going to say, oh, let's go to the HR director. I mean, that's not their first person they're going to go to. Probably some pharmacists have gotten an earful. Ms. Knight.
Representative Bigham and Representative De La Forest, I am not necessarily unhappy with Navitas once we get to them, because they do work with it. One of the problems that I have been talking about since late January, early February, when I was made aware by Navitas that there was a large number of people that they didn't get the prescription histories on, is we aren't getting in touch with those people. And so there's more of these letters. And this isn't the only letter that has had a short time frame on it. So I'm more concerned about the other people and that we're approaching this with a rifle when we need a shotgun. Because how many people are out there that are getting this and they're finding out that they're getting late notice, or they're going to be giving a week or even 30 days on a mental health drug? I mean, that is very upsetting to people. And the cases I hear about is when people are just off the chart upset, when they are just very upset. And I guess I have been disappointed, if in anything, by the lack of willingness to even contact the DDIRs such as myself and say, hey, we need your help on this. We know we didn't get prescription histories on people, and we're trying to keep this type of situation from occurring. can you help us get in touch with people? Be that put a note in their paycheck, be that send out an email. And I've been asking since February, what are we going to do to resolve this? What about the people that you don't have histories on? Rather than just let this thing percolate, let's be proactive so that people can get into their doctors and find out what would work.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McKnight and members, I don't want to prolong the committee because we're losing members as we go, and I need to go too. But I think what's significant to me, is it McKnight or Knight?
Knight.
Knight. Ms. Knight, I think one thing that's very significant to me, well, actually two, the scenarios that you painted did happen before Navitus and after, so
no.
they're not new.
This happened since January.
No, I'm making a comparison because personally one of the scenarios that you painted with dosage happened exactly like you said it far prior to the change, so they aren't new problems. But what's very significant that you said is that you've seen some improvements and that they handle the situations with you and work out a solution. And so I think the most important thing that you and other human resources directors can do is tell us as time goes on. Change is always difficult. Mm-hmm. And when there is change, especially in the healthcare arena, it creates a great deal of consternation, especially if you're the individual taking the prescription. And so I think the best thing that you can do is let us know if these incidents are lessening and if they are happening, if they're being handled well. We won't be incident-free. It'll never happen. The world's not perfect. But if the incidents are being handled well and they're lessening in number, then I think we've gotten someplace because we have to make changes. We have to do creative things and try things to lessen the cost of healthcare, or they're going to eat us alive. And so I'm really willing to try the changes, but we do need to hear from you as time progresses. Are the problems that we're experiencing getting better? And so I look forward, that's right, I won't be here. I'm sure my colleagues look forward to hearing in the future that the problems have lessened and become easier to solve.
Senator Betzel, did you have any questions?
I have none.
Representative De La Forest, any other questions? Any other? I guess my final thought is I would like to know sometime between, you know, now and maybe the next meeting, Mr. Morocco, what proactive approaches that you plan on taking to make sure that maybe even via a simple email to the members or something, what proactive approaches we can take to make sure that people are notified if some sort of, you know, coverage is changing or whatever way you want to handle it as far as the details. But I think that if these letters are going out, we may want to have a more proactive approach to notify people. So I guess by the next meeting, I would like to know what your plan is to do that.
Okay, Representative Bingham, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Okay, meeting's adjourned.